You know, somebody asked me recently how I came to do this work, how I came to do radio. And it was because I think this message has to go out to a larger audience. You know, when I talk about the work of holistic medicine, I'm always talking about all of the clinicians that are necessary to make holistic medicine possible. You know, I never refer to myself as an alternative practitioner because I say, what's the alternative to food? But not only that, alternative implies that you pick them or you pick us. Meaning you pick the straight apple medical arena or you pick somebody like me with a license as a nutrition counselor. But what's true is you need your MD and you need your chiropractor and you need your psychotherapist and your dentist and your priest or your rabbi or your fortune teller or your astrologer or whoever gives you guidance, and you need your massage therapist and you need your dentist, and we need somebody else in the studio to answer all these phones that are ringing because when we're here alone as programmers, I'm sorry, but we can't answer the phone and do the show at the same time. But you know, what's true is those of us that are in the arena of holistic medicine, well, we ride together. And whether you're an MD or a DO or a chiropractor or an acupuncturist or any of the other specialties I talked about, I think it comes under the umbrella of functional medicine. I really do like the term functional medicine the best because it's about improving your function. I like the term rational medicine, too. You know, if you break your leg, you don't need an herb. You need ER. And then after ER, you need an herb. And so every time I make the drive or the flight to go to a seminar, I'm always so impressed with the people that are in the room who come from all over the state in order to learn more about how to take care of, well, how to take care of you. How to take care of not only all of the patients that show up in their practice, but like myself, who are interested in community service and bringing out this message to you. So I hope that answers the question for the gal that called up and said, why do you do this? Well, I do this because I learned how to feel better. And so I want to teach other people how to feel better. And so my guest this morning, Dr. William Frederick Harvey, who most often comes on the third Monday of the month. We did a little switcheroo this month when we had our guest last week. But Dr. Harvey, how did you come to want to get into holistic medicine?
Well, I think it's probably similar to you. I was feeling rather badly in a practice of conventional medicine. Not only are the substances that we use often in conventional medicine toxic, but the practice itself was kind of toxic. It was really not conducive to my health or my family's health. And when I made a transition, I was really looking for something that would promote health because I was really tired of maintaining chronic illnesses poorly, which is basically what Western medicine...
Chronic illnesses poorly.
Yes. Western medicine is exceptional at treating acute illness. You broke a leg, you have a heart attack.
You put a stick in your eye.
Exactly. We can take care of immediate traumas and acute medical problems like massive infections generally well. But it's the chronic illness that Western medicine has such a problem with, because chronic illness is not about frank, in-your-face acute disease. It's about function.
Or in your eye stick.
It's chronic. It's functional illness. And that's not what medicine in the West addresses at this point.
Well, and pretty much if you look at what kills Americans, it is chronic illness. You know, when we take out all the accidents, it's heart disease and cancer are the biggest killers. But if we look around the world, the biggest killer is infection. You know, 50% of the deaths around the world are infection. In the United States, it's only 2%. But it seems like that could change.
Yes.
Probably all of you that are newspaper readers, and I know that the WSLR audience is very well informed, you might have noticed more and more little boxes showing up in the newspaper talking about infections of something called MRSA. And I did a show on MRSA earlier, last year, But we want to understand a little bit about methicillin-resistant staph aureus and the way that it affects us. And the reason that I'm particularly interested and the reason that this is showing up on a program about nutrition is real simple. What has happened is we have discovered this bacteria in pork, in pigs. And so when we look at the story that Nicholas Kristof revealed in the New York Times, what a beautiful investigative reporter, when he originally told the story about the late Dr. Tom Anderson, a family doctor in a little farm town in northwestern Indiana, one of the things that the doctor saw in his practice were an awful lot of rashes. You know, they started out as these little innocuous bumps. He actually called them pimples from hell. And then they became big lesions, big as saucers, fiery red, oozy, agonizing to the touch. They could be anywhere on the body, but more commonly were on the knees or the armpits or the face or the buttocks. And he sent the cultures off to the lab, and they reported that they were staph infections that were resistant to antibiotics. This superbug or flesh-eating bacteria is really something right out of science fiction movies. But what Dr. Anderson saw was an incredible number of them that were appearing in his little tiny community of 500 people. And so as he began to investigate, after seeing patient after patient in this tiny little Indiana town, he wondered about the hog farms that were outside of town. He wondered if the pigs could be incubating or even spreading the disease. He was pretty concerned about what he was seeing. And so he was ready to be a whistleblower. And so he contacted Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times. And, you know, that was really a bold move, because any insinuation that hog industry harms public health would certainly be an outrage to people that were making their living doing that. And so Nicholas Kristof made a plan to visit Camden, Indiana, and see Dr. Anderson and listen to his findings, and Dr. Anderson abruptly died. There was no autopsy. But a blood test suggested that he might have had a heart attack or an aneurysm. But Dr. Anderson himself had suffered through three bouts of MRSA, and a Dutch journal had recently linked pig-carried MRSA to a dangerous human heart inflammation. And so when we look at the model of agriculture that we have in this country that produces cheap bacon but really risks the health of all of us, we have to start to ask some questions about the antibiotic use in animals that is driving the resistance that is now showing up as MRSA. So, Dr. Harvey, talk to us about MRSA and how it evolved and what it is. And, well, we're going to start to talk about what we can do about it.
First, I'd like to just comment on that last thing you said about antibiotic use. I just read that a study from the USDA that 70% of all antibiotic use in the United States goes to animal husbandry. 70% of all antibiotic use. And you can imagine what that means, thinking of how many people actually walk into a doctor's office today and get an antibiotic script willy-nilly for a cold or whatever.
Well, upper respiratory, 75% of all the prescriptions that are written are for some sort of upper respiratory thing.
And who hasn't had a cold in the last 2 years that the doctor offered antibiotics, probably.
Right, colds are viruses, and antibiotics don't work on them.
Exactly.
But hey, I'm going to go you one better on your factoid.
What's that?
Here's a factoid that'll blow your mind. There are more antibiotics that are given to animals in North Carolina alone that are given to the entire population of the United States of America.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
That's an incredible figure. So MRSA. MRSA is an altered normal bug, essentially. Staphylococcus aureus is a normal flora of the human condition and of many animals. It's a very ubiquitous, find-it-everywhere bug, lives on your skin.
Lives
in your nose. Usually doesn't cause a problem. The MRSA becomes unique when it is subjected to antibiotics. What biology is really an incredible thing. It's so adaptable. When you stress an organism of any kind, it develops defense measures for these stresses. And one of the things that MRSA does is the antibiotics interfere with its metabolism. It finds a way around that problem in its own metabolism. It creates a way to inactivate the antibiotic, so it becomes resistant.
So really what it tells us is the most creative biologists on the planet are the bugs.
Yes, actually DNA and the intercellular machinery. We all are super creative scientists in our own systems. But these bugs are really brilliant in that within a generation, they can completely alter their genome. We take millions of years to do that, or thousands at least. This bug does it in one generation. So immediately upon stressing any antibiotic population with any bacterial population with any antibiotic, you're going to select out at least one resistant bug. If it lives, you've got a resistant strain.
Well, I call it the Plus 98 cockroach theory. It's not pretty, but it goes like this. You got a box with 100 roaches in it. You spray a bug spray in it, 98 of the roaches die, but two live. Which two live? The baddest boys in the box.
That's right.
Somehow they had resistance to that bug spray. So now you push the box in the corner for a month, and a month later you go back and there's 100 roaches in it. And now you have to, you use the same bug spray that you used the first time, only this time only about 30 of them die. Because now those two superbugs have created a whole generation of superbugs, so now you got to go get a stronger roach spray. So now you spray the stronger roach spray in the box, and ultimately 98 of them die, and which two live, and you see where we're going with that.
Exactly.
So essentially what we're doing is we're improving the immune system of the roaches by using bug spray.
Well, that's what we learned on Saturday at that conference. What even I were attending was a conference about future medicine, basically. And what it brought into my consciousness was it hits home on the interactive nature of all of our different genes and all of our different enzymes. When you stress out these bugs and you create the first super generation, and then you stress it again, this next super generation doesn't just have that one antibiotic resistance or a second antibiotic resistance. You stress out other areas of the organism, it starts developing other techniques to be even more virulent. And this is the problem with the MRSA. It's been stressed so many times. Methicillin is a super penicillin, which used to kill the penicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus that was generated from the 50s, 60s, 70s. Now we developed the methicillin-resistant one that was actually, methicillin was developed as a drug to kill off the penicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. Now we have a next generation of methicillin. Now we have vancomycin resistance.
We don't even want to go there today.
Super generations. But also, it turns on these other genes that the MRSA has.
So they become the Terminator.
They develop virulence factors. They have these products called leukocidin. Leuko is white in Latin. Leukocytes are white blood cells, your defense cells. They produce a toxic chemical called leukocidin. It's not in the original Staph aureus, but it's in this methicillin resistance one. Especially the community-acquired ones that come from pig farms, essentially.
So doesn't it make you want to go to North Carolina for the summer and play in the creek that is downstream from the drainage off of the poop-laden pig farm?
Absolutely.
Doesn't that make you want to have your kids go on the water slide in the, you know, it looks like a little picture-perfect creek. It was like when I lived in Colorado, and everybody in would come to Colorado, and they would see these beautiful burbling mountain creeks, and they all look like Coors commercials, right? And so they all wanted to jump in the creek, even though it was probably 40 degrees, you know, and they didn't realize that there was a moose or an elk or a deer, you know, 50 yards upstream that was putting their droppings in the stream that had Giardia in it.
Right.
You know, one of the parasites. You know, they didn't realize that all of those mountains were filled with mines and tailing fields. And so as a result, all the dust that was blowing into these streams was the remnants of tin mines and copper mines and all of this. I mean, the heavy metal contamination just in the air in Colorado is unbelievable. I mean, you could literally wave a slide through the air and put it under a microscope, you know, and identify metals in it. And so the same thing, you know, if in North Carolina alone, there are as many antibiotics that are used every year on the animals that are used in the entire United States of America, then that means that the resistant bacteria that those chickens and pigs have, because North Carolina is mostly chicken and pig farms, that, you know, their excrement is going to end up in the water table. Those bacteria end up in the water table, and they end up in the creek that you were taking little Bobby to play for the summer.
And in the lake where you frolic with all the five creeks feeding into it.
Right. And, of course, you banged your leg on the canoe when you got out of it, and you went, oh, it's just a little cut. It doesn't need any attention. And now, 4 days after you get back from your North Carolina vacation, you got an oozy sore on your leg, and whoops.
It's MRSA.
It's MRSA. And unfortunately, that was a story that I heard.
All too often. The problem with this MRSA-laden pork, though, is just what you said, that little bump on the knee. If you have a small cut on your hand and you're handling this pork, even if you're using safe technique, you can get MRSA in that cut on your hand while you're handling the pork, getting ready to cook it to well done so you can kill off the bacteria. But too late, the bacteria's already entered your hand through that small cut.
Do we? Well, I mean, I think we got hipper about raw chicken and salmonella, raw turkey and salmonella. You know, when we realized that the federal regulations are that you can't have more than 50% of your crop have salmonella. isn't that comforting? That's so comforting to know only 50% of all the turkeys sold, 50% of all the chickens sold have salmonella. Okay, so you flip the coin. You're, you know, one out of two chances.
Well, that's what the federal government recommends, but there was a study done 2 years ago where they sampled just some random Tyson from the grocery store chickens, and 96% of them had salmonella on it.
Right. So when we look, but we do have to applaud Tyson Foods, though. Tyson Foods at least has been one of the companies that stopped using arsenic in their feed, which is used as an antiparasitic agent. And so, you know, one of the things that happens is when you get people to stop using antibiotics, they start using arsenic.
Right.
As
and
a growth mediator.
96% of the other samples had arsenic.
Right. I mean,
but so, Tyson did step up to the bat, though. After that study, they really did try to police up their system.
Well, and apparently it's worked. And so, you know, we want to applaud these companies that are making these really, really very righteous efforts in order to clean up the system. But, you know, the system is screwed from the get-go.
Right.
Because the conversation that you and I had on the drive up and the drive back from Orlando this weekend was about the fact that we are still linked to the agribusiness, and that includes all the livestock industries, are linked to the chemical industry and the pharmacology industry.
Well, it's linked to our whole cultural system of belief that some greater power gave us this planet to do whatever the heck we want to with it without regard to anything else, and disconnected us from all the life on the planet.
Well, and that I get to fill my pockets full of money while I sell you contaminated food.
Yes. The greed factor is really there.
But, you know, if you follow the money, it goes from the chemical industry to the pharmaceutical industry, and from the pharmaceutical industry to agribusiness and to animal husbandry. So, you know, we go back to the fact that it's the support of the chemical industry that is really the foundation in our federal government of the ongoing approval of giving antibiotics to animals that are healthy. Now, think about that. Would you give your child his bowl of Cocoa Puffs in the morning with a capsule of antibiotics on the top? Well, we know if you listen to No Nonsense Nutrition that you're not giving your kids sugar bombs for breakfast. But let's say you went to the health food store and you bought the best organic milk and you bought the best organic cereal and you did all of those things. Would you open up a capsule of antibiotics and put it on your kid's cereal every single morning just because your child might get exposed to somebody who had an infection at school that day? And the answer is
no,
of course not. How ridiculous. And yet, we turn around and feed antibiotics to well animals 365 days out of the year. Hello?
Totally screwing up the system. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. It's not even preventive medicine. It's just actually toxic medicine. Preventive medicine means use better technique to prevent the infection. Don't blast with antibiotics to hopefully avoid some kind of infection at the same time creating worse ones.
So when penicillin came out in the 1940s, you know, I met a doctor when I was living in Colorado, and he was in his 90s at the time, and he was in practice at the point that penicillin was released. And he said, Eve, it was a miracle.
Truly.
It was an absolute miracle. He said, prior to that, one out of every two patients I had who had pneumonia died.
Yes.
One out of every two. What a heartache as a physician to have seen that.
And to be able to do nothing about it.
And then to have penicillin show up and all of a sudden, everybody, virtually everybody survived. And so it's real easy to see that this wonder drug was in fact exactly that. It was a wonder. People survived who in the past would have died.
Right.
And then we started using it for more and more things. And within 15 years, we already were beginning to develop penicillin resistance. Bacteria that when you expose them to penicillin went na-na-na-na-na. Because when I talked to him, when he first began using penicillin, he used it in the dozens of units. Dozens of units. 24 units. 60 units. Then, he said, by the time that 1950 rolled around, he was using it in thousands of units. And by the time he had retired from medicine, he was using 24 million units in order to treat pneumonia.
Right. That was standard when
so
I started.
When you started, mm-hmm. that was standard. And yet, when he started, it was dozens of units.
Yeah. And since I've been there, we've added five different classes of antibiotics, 10 in each class. I mean, it's just amazing how many different things are out there now because we've kept selecting more and more resistant organisms.
Well, but the American public still believes that they're just out there developing another antibiotic to take care of this problem.
We're getting to the end of the line.
And hey, you got to wake up and smell the decaf here, the organic decaf, of course. But the thing that I saw in 1983, when HIV really showed up on the scene, if you went into any research university anywhere in the United States, the bacteriology department was the six-story building, and the virology department was in a closet at the basement of the library.
Right.
And then HIV showed up. And all of a sudden, virology got to be the big dog, and they got all the funds pushed at them because of HIV. Now, if you travel to any of the research universities in the United States, the virology department is the 6- and 10-story building, and the bacteriology department is in a broom closet. And so the idea that we're out there developing all of these antibiotics, get real, it ain't happening.
None of the big pharma have much in the way of pipelines for antibiotics at this point because they're really focused on the super drugs to kill these super bugs and not just general stuff, and they're finding fewer and fewer of these super drugs for the super bugs.
Well, the thing that's astounding is that, you know, 8 years ago, we had one case of MRSA at Sarasota Memorial Hospital, and then the next year we had 14, and the next year we had 72, and then they stopped giving us the numbers.
Right.
Because now they're in the thousands. And what's true is that now we've seen that these MRSA bacteria, they're everywhere.
Yes.
When they did the study of people who work in infectious disease, they examined their cell phones, and they found out that everybody that worked in infectious disease had MRSA bacteria all over their cell phones.
Yes, it's everywhere. It's on.
Which
it's
they then hand to their kid to make a call at the ball game.
Yeah.
So just because you get exposed to MRSA doesn't mean you get MRSA. In fact, you could actually have, you want a really scary thought, you could actually have MRSA living in your nose or living on your skin right now. And that may be what happened when Michael Jackson went in for his newest reconstructive nose surgery. You know, I read those British newspapers and those British tabloids. You know, I'm an Anglophile.
They're
I love
merciless.
That stuff. They're merciless. And they're talking about the fact that when Michael Jackson went in to get that little nub thing that's left on his face that's supposed to be a nose reconstructed again, because, you know, he's going to go out on a new tour.
Yes.
That, you know, he's got one of these antibiotic-resistant infections. Well, operate on a nose, you're definitely dealing with the petri dish of the body.
Yep.
So you could have MRSA living on you and not in you, but on you right now. But you know what? Your body keeps it in check. Your immune system is powerful enough that it is able to corral it. It doesn't overcome it, But just like a really good lawn that's full of great grass, it squeezes out the weeds, the same thing happens in the body when we have a lot of good guy bacteria. It helps to keep the bad guy bacteria in check. Do you agree, Dr. Harvey?
Yes, I agree entirely.
And so when we look at, you know, these differences in words, let's think of antimicrobial and antibiotic and antibacterial and what they mean. You know, when we look at antimicrobial, that's sort of a general term that's given to substances that kill or slow the growth of any microbe. A microbe is just a collective name that's given to bacteria, not only Staphylococcus aureus, but viruses and even funguses. So when we talk about antimicrobials, we can be talk about stuff like Tamiflu that Dr. Harvey and I talked about, an antiviral that treats the flu. We could be talk about Lamisil that treats athlete's foot. Or we could talk about tetracycline that is often used to treat urinary tract infections. But when we move into this category called an antibiotic is a medicine that's designed to kill or slow the growth of bacteria and some fungi. But antibiotics are used specifically to fight bacterial infections, but they can't fight against infections caused by viruses like Tamiflu does. So an example would be things like Zithromax or vancomycin, this last line of defense for these MRSA infections. And then another word you hear is antibacterial. This is a term that's given to substances that kill or slow the growth of bacteria when treating surfaces, whether it's your skin or the countertop. So these would be things like hand soaps and dishwashing detergents and like that. But, you know, what we're looking at is these antibacterial products like the gels and pumps and hand lotions and soaps and things like that. They even may be contributing to some bacterial resistance. Plus, some of the compounds that they're using are getting into our water supply. They're getting into our groundwater. And so those compounds that actually have an antibacterial effect, once again, they may be promoting the immune system of the bacteria collectively. And
yes.
So I just want to give those
stress,
as
another stress on the bacteria helps it get stronger.
I just want people, I hear people mix that stuff up.
Yes.
Antimicrobe, antibacterial, antifungal, antiviral, antimicrobial. And so a little bit of definition that's there.
But truly, the best antibacterial hand wash you can do is just that. Wash your hands.
Well,
soap
but wash
and water.
Wash your hands and say the alphabet. You know, I was really helped tremendously. Actually, it was at one of the conferences that you and I often frequent when I was in the bathroom afterward. And it was funny because you and I had that conversation on Saturday that you saw three people walk out of the bathroom without washing their hands.
Right before lunch.
And they were medical practitioners.
Yes.
That's astounding.
Frightening.
So anyway, I was in the bathroom and I was washing my hands, and I do what I thought was a thorough job. You know, I do my whole hand and in between my fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to rinse my hand, and the gal next to me was an ID nurse. She was an infectious disease nurse that I've seen at very many of these seminars. And she turned to me and she said, "Say the alphabet when you wash." And I said, "Excuse me?" And she said, "You need to wash your hands long enough to say the whole alphabet." So then when I put the soap in my hands again and went A, B, C, D, E, F, G, I was washing up to H. Maybe I was washing up to J or M if I had dirty fingernails.
Right.
But that was, I thought, a really, really good clue as to how long we need to wash our hands. And that's all it takes. You don't have to be using no fancy $4 a bottle antimicrobial soap.
Right.
All you need to do is, golly, really wash your hands, and especially after you pick your nose, we might add. So now let's look at the Get Smart program that our federal government has started, because the federal government realizes the tremendous health costs. Now, what's interesting to me is the federal government will support Big Pharma in giving antibiotics to people that are growing this livestock so that they can use it on your chicken sandwich and your bacon for breakfast and your roast that you're going to have for dinner tonight. But the campaign to affect health came long after they were concerned about the health of the animals. I'm not sure if that made sense to you, but it made sense to me. But then again, I'm blonde. But the federal government has created, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta has created a national campaign for appropriate antibiotic use in the community. And when they started this, I don't know, about 12 years ago or so, it just sort of went nowhere. And then about 5 years ago, they started a program called Get Smart, Know When Antibiotics Work. And so I think you're going to see a big uptick in this national media campaign of Get Smart, Know When Antibiotics Work. And it's helping people to understand that antibiotics are overused.
But this is directed at humans.
Right, exactly.
Well, this is not where the big problem is. We have 70% of antibiotic use happening in animals, in animal husbandry. So is Get Smart going to help the animal farmers?
Well, and it's not going to make a darn bit of difference in terms of the animal farmers, but let's first off look at how we can protect ourselves in terms of behaviors that we might change.
Right.
Which is not going, doctor, I need a Z-Pak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I see in my practice. And I especially see it in children with ear infections.
Yes.
Even though 75% of ear infections resolve themselves within 24 hours if you just give a kid a decongestant.
And about 75% of acute bronchitis in otherwise healthy adults resolves itself. You can't go to the doctor with 3 days of phlegm and say, oh my God, it's terrible, I need an antibiotic. 3 days is about when you're peaking from the viral infection. Give it a week. It's going to go away. 3 weeks till complete resolution of the symptoms, but if you don't do anything about it, but it's that first week when people are coming in, I've got a lot of mucus, it's kind of greenish, and I need an antibiotic. And that's not when you need the antibiotic. It's
Green,
3 weeks if it's still...
Green mucus and yellow mucus alone are not necessarily indicators of infection.
It just indicates that you have an excessive, or not an excessive, but probably an appropriate white blood cell response, because you get pussy mucus because you have white blood cells putting all their chemicals into the mix.
And these white blood cells, they're like little Pac-Men. They go in there and they actually eat the viruses and the bacteria. Or they make a germicide. They actually make a bug remover, if you will, that they can either inject into the virus or they can secrete to change the mechanism of the virus.
Right.
And so, you know, when my grandma said, if you treat a cold, it lasts 7 days, and if you don't treat a cold, it lasts a week, you know, we used to laugh like crazy as kids when we would hear, oh, grandma, you're so silly. But what happens is you get a virus, and on day one, you're starting to go down, and on day two, you're knowing you're infected, and then day three, you got a head full of snodge, and then you call the doctor, and you go in on day four, and you're just miserable, and you're behind on your work, and you go, give me an antibiotic, and then day five, you're still lousy, and day six, you're better, but guess what? You'd have gotten better anyway.
Right.
Hello? So when we look at that 75% of all office-based prescribing is for ear infections, sinusitis, sore throats, or properly called pharyngitis, bronchitis, and the common cold. Hello, you need to learn about some therapies that you can use when you have a sore throat, when you have an ear infection, when you have sinusitis. We'll do shows on every single one of those subjects and give you strategies that you can use. What you got to, if you want to start making this change, start it with you. Stop demanding antibiotics, either for yourself or for your child. And so the Get Smart campaign is about addressing the fact that antibiotics are most often used for upper respiratory stuff, whether it's your throat, your nose, or your chest, and you can reduce your own building of resistance by finding other strategies to use.
And that's really important, because it is your own resistance that protects against this. Let's go back to MRSA, the flesh-eating bug. The reason it's flesh-eating...
Wait a minute. Do that again. Say that again.
You need to do things to protect yourself against this flesh-eating bug.
There needs to be some of that dramatic music in the background, Dr. Harvey.
You need to bring a soundtrack in here. You're a good one anyway. So the... the things you can do really are about keeping your body just functionally well. Good sleep, good food, exercise, and good nutritional supplementation.
Well, let's expand on that. Good sleep means you never get less than 50 hours a week. That's 7 times 7 plus 1.
That's a really good rule.
You can't get less than 50 hours a week. That's all there is to it. And so any of these people that come to me and they go, oh, well, as I've gotten older, I only need 5 hours of sleep. No, you're delusional.
That's right.
You're delusional because you're only getting 5 hours of sleep.
And you've convinced yourself that this is good.
And this is not good. You do not need less sleep as you age.
No, and you don't need less sleep because you function well anyway. No.
And so if you're sleeping more than 10 hours a night, there is something wrong with you.
If you're sleeping less than 7 hours a night, there's something wrong with you.
And so you need to address that because a huge big part of your immune system is triggered on as a result of sleep. Now, you say good food. You know, I got to laugh at that one, Dr. Harvey. And the reason I have to laugh is the number of people that hand me a food diary over the last 30 years.
And say they eat well.
They say they eat well, and I read their food diary, and it's all I can do to keep from making some horrible screaming sound and running from the room. Because I look at this and I go, oh my.
Yes.
You're astounded at what people think is a good diet.
Well, I had a friend I was talking with yesterday, based on conversations we've had since the conference we saw in New York a month ago, and then this last one. I was already on the track, but I've really decreased the amount of animal product that I've been eating and eating more plants. And I told my friend yesterday that the crucial key to it all is to eat more plants. He said, "I'll have French fries every day."
Oh, good. Oh, good. He and Michelle Obama, huh? She said she could live on French fries.
She could have a pound of plants a day. There you go.
There you go. Well, I mean, that is the single most frequently eaten vegetable in America.
Yes, that
iceberg lettuce, potatoes as French fries,
ketchup,
and tomatoes as pizza sauce and ketchup. Those are the three most commonly eaten vegetables. Well, the nature of not only getting your sleep and eating a quality diet, which means you're eating never less than a quart of vegetables a day. Never less than a quart of vegetables a day. Did I mention that you should never eat less than a quart of vegetables a day?
Did you forget the pint of fruit?
Well, I didn't forget the pint of fruit, but I really want to hammer the vegetables.
It's
because
true.
The stats are really pro the vegetables,
it
even
really
more
is.
Than they are pro the fruit. So when we look at that, we also have to look at nutrients. You know, I'm thinking about getting a card printed for the next time somebody says, but can't you do it all with your food? Why do I have to take the pills?
There's just not enough in the food.
We need to understand that even with organic food, oh my God, organic food is so much better when we reduce the toxic load from the pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides. But when we realize that only 3% of the food consumed in the United States now is organic, we know we've got to have a bigger impact. So even if you're not eating organic, eating those dark colored, bright colored vegetables every day, reducing the total volume of animal food that you have, and choosing animal food that is not treated with antibiotics. When you go to the market, you can see it right on the label of the chicken, grown without the use of antibiotics.
I know. There's going to be an argument, though. All of these organic meats cost twice as much as the regular
meats. Well, but I'm differentiating here, Dr. Harvey, between grown without the use of antibiotics and organic. Those are two different critters.
But even the ones that are grown without the use of antibiotics cost more, from what I've seen.
20 cents a pound, maybe. Not very much. There's not a big spread on those anymore. There was when they first started coming to the marketplace.
So it's come closer.
I really don't see that
anymore.
But
even in this economy, it's still going to cost more. The rationale that I use is eat less, because that's the key. Eat
less. Well, the rationale that I use is take the damn diet sodas and the chips and the Jive food out of your case and eat one less meal out every week. And you can pay for high quality food.
All that Jive processed food costs more than the regular whole food that you'd be eating.
Well, if we just take all the stuff that looks like food out of the carton, I mean out of the grocery cart, you know, there's a lot of looks like food.
This is true.
And it's not food. You know, if it doesn't grow out of the ground or grow on a tree or walk around, it ain't food. So
fruit roll-ups may have the name fruit in them.
Right. Sunny Delight has 10% real fruit juice.
And it was under the sun at one point inside a fruit, but
yeah, right. I mean, get real. Just because you go to, you know, one of the health food stores and you buy organic chocolate chip cookies does not make that a good diet. You know, so it doesn't mean that if you have a cookie, I want you to have the worst cookie. It's just saying that, you know, the biggest growth industry in organics is in drinks and snacks.
Yes.
I don't necessarily think that's a plus.
Oh, Newman's Own started with salad dressing. They have 1,000 cookie varieties now.
Right. Yeah, it's really been a shift. So what are we going to do about it besides scare you? Well, the first thing you're going to do is stop buying meat that is grown with the use of antibiotics. We need to start sending a message to the marketplace. And the message has to go to the people in Congress, to the people in power, to stop the subsidies for the nature of the use of antibiotics. You know, in the country of Germany, antibiotics have been banned in raising chickens. They have to use homeopathy in order to treat the chickens. You know, the place in the world where this new resistant strain of MRSA, and you say resistant strain, yeah, vancomycin, which has been the antibiotic that has been used to kill MRSA, we've now created a MRSA that's even vanco-resistant, and that showed up in the Netherlands, what you might still call Holland, a lot of pig farms there. And there have been significant numbers of deaths from the vanco-resistant MRSA, which is now being called VRSA, that's showing up in the Netherlands, and now it showed up in the United States. Well, we got some good news on the side, and the good news is that we found something that actually works to kill MRSA. Garlic. Yes, garlic. Patients who suffered, in some instances for years, with weeping infected wounds have been cleared of MRSA by using garlic both internally and topically at a cream, and this was done at the University of East London. 250 people have been treated successfully so far. The journal Advances in Therapy has printed a study on the first 52 patients that were treated with garlic. Some of the volunteers had wounds that refused to heal for years despite IV delivery of vancomycin. And by the way, I do have to remind you that if you contract MRSA and are treated with vancomycin, it is an intravenous drip that is given to you every day for 4 to 6 weeks in order to treat it. So these individuals were all confirmed that they carried the drug-resistant hospital superbug. But the majority of them were healed in 8 to 12 weeks of treatment with garlic. Garlic has a couple of ingredients in it, alanine and alanase. And you've heard before in no-nonsense nutrition that things that end in an ASE are enzymes. So when you crush a garlic clove, the alanase, the enzyme, works on the alanine, the compound, and creates a compound called alanicin. And that is the active ingredient. That's why those garlic tablets that have had the odor removed that are very popular out in the marketplace, the reason they don't work on this is because it's the odor that actually makes it work. And so when you go to use garlic, always bash it with the back of your knife and crush it a little bit and let it sit on the counter for 5 minutes before you put it in your pot of soup or put it in your salad dressing and allow the alanase time to make the alanicin. And so there are products that are out there that are, have, you know, documented amounts of alanicin, but actually, this is the only thing that worked. And the remarkable story was a woman who had scoliosis. And individuals that have scoliosis, which is a curvature of the spine, often have to have a pretty horrible surgery to have rods placed in their back in order to straighten it out. And this is where we're seeing a lot of these MRSA infections, is in hospitals. And so when this wound, the skin is punctured, whether it's with a catheter or an injection or a surgery, this is the place that MRSA can enter the body. And so she was supposed to be in the hospital for 3 weeks for this particular surgery, and she ended up being in there for 4 months. And the wounds were horrible. And so they tried everything. They said there was nothing that they could do. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't even remove the rods. They couldn't do any more procedures. She suffered for 2 years with this infection until they treated her with garlic. And so it took her 18 weeks. You know, it took 4.5 months until they got her cleared up. But between using the garlic cream topically and using the garlic internally, she had a healing. And so we're back to natural remedies, aren't we, doctor?
That's awesome. I love biology. Again, garlic, when you stress it slightly by cutting it or crushing it, you expose some of those cells to air. It releases this alanase, which then creates allicin. And allicin is a toxin to bacteria. And so it's a stress response mechanism. Just like the bacteria use when it's stressed by antibiotics and turns into a resistant something, the garlic, in the plant world, the garlic has created an antibiotic out of a stress need. It's really amazing.
Well, but the allicin, you know, because there are so many compounds. I mean, those are the compounds that we know the name of in garlic.
Right.
But garlic and chocolate so far are the two foods that have more compounds than they could even list. They haven't even found all the compounds in there. But it attacks the bacteria on so many different fronts. It appears that the adaptation that the bugs have to change their internal structure to become resistant to antimicrobial drugs don't work with garlic. And so, you know, I can remember when I was living in Arizona and I was working with some of the first Americans, the Native American populations, and we had populations, they had no money. They had, you know, they didn't have any drugs. They only used herbs. Some of the Hopi and the Navajo and the Hualapai and the Supai medicine people that I worked with, they, you know, antibiotics to them were alternative medicine.
Right.
And so the very first time that I saw someone take a garlic clove, take a pin and stick a whole bunch of holes, just break the edge of it, you know, not enough to destabilize the garlic, but just to break the edge of it and put it in somebody's nostril. And I was like, oh my, these people are so backwards. Well, how ignorant was I? Because the idea wasn't to leave the garlic sticking in your nose all day. Can you imagine this pretty sight? But the circumstances were that as I understood microbiology better, I understood why it knocked out the infection that that person had. Because simply the breathing of the garlic and the constant contact with the internal blood vessels of the nose were enough to put enough of that compound into the system that it knocked the infection out.
Well, here's one. If you're brave, crush a clove. If you get a cold, crush a clove of garlic that first day, sit it on the cutting board, go and get a cup of water, put in your quarter teaspoon of salt, eighth of a teaspoon of baking soda, heat it up a bit, throw the crushed clove of garlic into the water, stir it up, put it in your neti pot, and snort that baby. Yes, you will see
stars,
stars, to say the least, but it is effective. It really reduces the viruses.
Okay, so they're going to be calling
attack.
Us back for the recipe, Dr. Harvey, so repeat it again. A cup of water.
Cup of water.
Quarter teaspoon. A clove of crushed garlic.
A quarter teaspoon of salt and eighth of a teaspoon of baking soda. Warm water, filtered, distilled, whatever you want to use. No chlorine, not tap water. And use that as your nasal douche to clean out the virus.
And so neti pot is an instrument that is used to pour water up your nose. So it's a very specific instrument. It's been used in Ayurvedic medicine now for about 3,000 years. And I have a client and she uses an old ketchup bottle.
You
with
can
a
use
squeezy,
your hand.
With a squeezy on it. You just snort it out of your hand. That's the way that it works. But there's more promise on the horizon for things that help to not only treat the MRSA, but help us be smart about not being exposed. If you have to go to the hospital for any procedure at all, you have got to be your own advocate and make sure that no practitioner in that hospital puts their hands on you until they've sanitized them.
Yes.
You know, wash your hands. Get your clinicians to wash their hands. Make them do it right in front of you.
And remind them to do the alphabet while they're doing it.
Right. And be a pain in the butt and insist on those kinds of things. Wash your hands more often. Keep wounds covered. I see people that come into the clinic and they've got a cut and they don't put a Band-Aid on it.
Oh, there's a wives' tale that if you leave it open, it gets harder or something. No, cover it. Keep those bacteria away from it.
That's exactly right. So there are things that you can do. You know, our purpose here on No Nonsense Nutrition is to make you aware.